pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a woman who couldn't get an American flight school to so much as look at her, so she taught herself French, boarded a steamship, and went and got her license from the same outfit that trained the aces of the Great War. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar where we keep the old stories flying. Today we're talking about Bessie Coleman, Queen Bess, and if you've never heard the name, well, that's exactly why we're going to spend the next little while on her. Now, before we get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And believe me, the woman we're talking about today earned every ounce of hers. Check them out at AviationSold.com. All right, let's set the scene. It's the year 1922. Picture a grass field in the flat farm country outside of Chicago. The airplanes of the day are canvas and wire and wood, mostly war surplus trainers, the Curtiss JN4, the one everybody called the Jenny, a 90-horsepower engine up front that clatters and pops and throws castor oil back in your face until your goggles are slick with it. No brakes worth the name, no radio, no parachute in most of them. You point the nose down the grass, firewall the throttle, and you hope. And standing next to one of those Jennies is a young black woman in a leather coat and a pilot's cap. And she is about to do something no black woman in America has ever done in public. She is about to fly. But let me back up. Because to understand how big that moment was, you've got to understand where she started. Bessie Coleman was born in 1992. Now hold on, let me get that right. 1892. In Atlanta, Texas. A little town up in the northeast corner of the state. She was one of 13 children. Her father was of Cherokee and African-American descent. Her mother was African-American and they were sharecroppers. That means they worked land they didn't own, for a share of a crop that mostly went to somebody else. Bessie picked cotton as a girl. She walked 4 miles to a one-room schoolhouse when there was school to walk to because the picking season came first. But here's the thing about Bessie. She could do numbers. She kept the books for the family cotton accounts and she was good at it. She had a mind that wanted more than that dusty little town could give her. She saved up, went off to college in Oklahoma, and the money ran out after a single term. One term, so she did what a lot of folks did in those years. She followed her brothers north to Chicago, part of that great migration of black families leaving the South looking for something better. And in Chicago, she became a manicurist, a very good one. She worked in a barber shop on the South Side, the White Sox barber shop on the Stroll, right in the heart of black Chicago. And that's where the flying bug bit her. Because the men coming back from France, from the First World War, they'd sit in that shop and tell stories, stories about airplanes, about dogfights over the trenches, about what the world looked like from up top, and one of her brothers, a fellow named John, he liked to needle her. He'd been overseas and he'd tease her that French women were better than American women because French women could fly airplanes and Bessie never would. Now here's where it gets interesting. Most people, you say that to them, they let it go. Bessie didn't let it go. She decided she was going to fly. Not someday she was going to fly. So she started knocking on doors, and every single door in America slammed shut. Understand what she was up against in 1920. If you were a woman, the flight schools didn't want you. If you were black, the flight schools really didn't want you. And if you were both, well, there simply was no door for her to walk through. Not one American instructor would take her money. A lot of folks would have stopped right there, and nobody would have blamed them. But Bessie had met a man named Robert Abbott. And if you know your history, you know that name. Robert Abbott founded the Chicago Defender, one of the most important black newspapers in the country, a powerful man. And Abbott told her something that changed everything. He said, "If America won't teach you, go to France. Over there they'll train a woman. Over there they'll train you." So Bessie Coleman, the cotton picker's daughter, the manicurist from the South Side, sat down and she learned to speak French. At a school in the Chicago Loop, at night after work, she saved her money from the barbershop, and Abbott and another businessman helped sponsor her, and in November of 1920, she got on a boat and crossed the Atlantic Ocean to learn to do the one thing her own country told her she could not. Let that settle in for a second. She crossed an ocean for a chance. She went to a town called Le Crotoy, up on the northern coast of France, to the flying school run by the Caudron brothers, aircraft builders, and she trained on a French machine, the Nieuport, a biplane. The trainer version had a rotary engine, that wild kind of engine where the whole cylinder block spins around with a propeller, throwing oil, dragging the airplane around on you with all that spinning mass. You had to fly it with your feet as much as your hands. And the training was brutal, and it was dangerous. During the 10 months she was there, she reportedly saw another student die in a crash at the field. She kept flying, long days. A stick with no throttle in the way you'd think of one, a lot of it done by cutting the ignition, blipping the engine on and off. Open cockpit. the North Sea wind coming in cold and wet. And on June 15, 1921, Bessie Coleman was granted her pilot's license by the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, the international body that certified aviators the world over, the FAI. She was the first Black woman in the entire world to hold an international pilot's license, the first Native American woman too, and she'd done it in France, in a language she'd taught herself on borrowed money, because home wouldn't have her. She came back to America in the fall of 1921, and the Black press met her at the dock like a hero, because she was one. Now, a license is one thing. Making a living is another. Back then, there were no airlines to hire you, no corporate flight departments. If you wanted to fly for money, you barnstormed. You put on a show. You went from town to town with a war surplus Jenny, and you did loops and rolls and spins over a county fairground, and you charged folks to watch. And if they were brave, you charged them for a ride. And Bessie realized her French license, good as it was, hadn't taught her the wild stuff, the stunt flying. So what does she do? She gets back on a boat. She goes back to Europe, this time to France and to Germany and the Netherlands, and she seeks out the best stunt pilots and aircraft designers she can find, and she learns the aerobatic trade from the people who invented it. The figure eights, the loops, the tail spins, the near ground passes that make a crowd gasp. She came home the second time, in 1922, ready. And on September 3, 1922, out on Long Island, at Curtis Field, Bessie Coleman gave her first public flight exhibition in the United States. The Chicago Defender billed her as the world's greatest woman flyer. Thousands came to watch. And they gave her a name that stuck, Queen Bess. For the next few years, she flew that circuit. And I want you to picture what that was really like. Because we romanticize barnstorming, and it was romantic, but it was also filthy, dangerous, hand-to-mouth work. The airplane smells like hot oil and dope, that lacquer they painted on the fabric to shrink it tight, a sharp banana and varnish smell that got into everything. The engine in front of you is loud enough to leave your ears ringing for hours after you land. You're sitting out in the open, wind tearing at you, and you're flying an airplane that was built to be cheap and expendable for the war and then sold off for a few hundred dollars. Things broke. Cables frayed, engines quit, and when they quit, you had a glider, and you found a cow pasture, and you dead-sticked it in. Bessie crashed. In 1923, out in California, her Jenny's engine failed on a climb out, and she went down hard, broke a leg, cracked some ribs. She was laid up in a hospital for weeks, and from that hospital bed, she sent word to her fans. She said, "Tell them that as soon as I can walk, I'm going to fly," and she did. Now here's the part that I think matters most, the part that lifts Bessie Coleman above just being the first at something. She had a mission. She wasn't flying just for herself. She refused to perform for segregated crowds. There's a story down in her home state of Texas in Waxahachie, where she was set to do a show and the organizers wanted Black spectators to come in through one gate and white spectators through another. Two gates, Bessie said no, she would not fly unless everybody came through the same gate. Now the grandstand seating stayed segregated. That was more than she could break in a single afternoon. But she made them tear down that divided entrance. Same gate for everybody. She used the only leverage she had, which was that she was the show, and if she didn't fly, there was no show. And her dream, her real dream, the thing she was working toward was a flight school, a school for young Black aviators back home in America, so that the next Bessie Coleman would never have to cross an ocean to chase the sky. She lectured in churches and theaters. She'd show film of her flying and talk to the crowds, especially the young folks. And she'd tell them the air was the one place with no barriers. If only somebody would open the door, she was saving toward that school. One exhibition at a time, one lecture at a time. She almost got there. April the 30th, 1926, Jacksonville, Florida. Bessie had a new airplane, a Curtis Jenny she'd recently purchased, and a mechanic and publicity man named William Wills was flying it down for her from Texas. The next day there was going to be a big exhibition, a benefit, and Bessie was going to do a parachute jump as part of it. That evening they went up to scout the field and plan the jump. Wills was flying, Bessie was in the other seat. And here's a detail that tells you everything about how much she was thinking about that jump. She wasn't wearing her seatbelt. She had it unfastened and she was leaning out over the side, looking down at the ground below, planning where she'd come down under the canopy the next day. About 10 minutes into the flight at around 2,000 feet, the airplane suddenly nosed over and went into a dive, and then it flipped. Something had jammed the controls. When they went through the wreckage later, they found a wrench. A loose wrench had slid forward into the control gears and locked them up. And when that airplane flipped upside down, Bessie Coleman, with her belt unfastened, leaning out to study the ground, fell from the cockpit. She fell about 2,000 feet. She was killed instantly. She was 34 years old. Wills couldn't recover the airplane and died in the crash and the fire that followed. A loose wrench, that's all it took. 34 years old. And the school she dreamed of still just a dream in a savings account. 10,000 people came to her memorial in Chicago. Ida B. Wells, the great journalist and activist, presided over the service, and they buried Queen Bess in Lincoln Cemetery on the South Side, not far from that barbershop where a brother's teasing had lit the whole thing off. But you know, this is aviation, and in aviation the good stories don't end at the grave, they catch a tailwind. Because Bessie's dream didn't die with her. A few years later, in 1929, a man named William Powell, a black aviator inspired by her example, founded the Bessie Coleman Aero Club out in Los Angeles to open flying to black Americans exactly the way she'd wanted. And in the years after, groups of black pilots would fly over her grave every Memorial Day and drop flowers from the air, flowers from an airplane, onto the grave of the woman who taught them it could be done. And you can draw a straight line, a real one, from Bessie Coleman to the Tuskegee Airmen who flew and fought in the Second World War. She kicked the door. Others walked through it. That's how it works. That's how it always works. They've honored her since, and about time too. There's a road at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago named Bessie Coleman Drive. The Postal Service put her on a stamp back in 1995, and just a few years ago they put her face on the quarter, the 25-cent piece, part of the American Women series. So it's entirely possible you've had Bessie Coleman in your pocket and never knew it. Next time you get a quarter, take a look. You might be holding Queen Bess. Here's what I keep coming back to, sitting here thinking about her. We talk a lot on this show about the barriers in flying. Weather, airspace, density, altitude, the physics that'll kill you if you get sloppy, those are real and we respect them. But Bessie Coleman was up against a different kind of barrier, the kind that has nothing to do with lift or thrust or the honest laws of the air, the kind that people build. And she went around it the hard way, learned a language, crossed an ocean, twice, and came home with wings that her own country had refused to hand her, and then spent every dollar and every breath trying to hold that door open behind her. Back when avgas was cheap and airspace was free, it still took uncommon nerve to do what she did. She had it in spades. My thanks today to the historians and archives who keep her story alive, to the Chicago Defender that championed her when she was living it, and to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, whose records on Queen Bess I leaned on for this one. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com, and the next time you're up there on a clean, quiet evening, with the whole world laid out below your wing, spare a thought for the manicurist from the South Side who wanted that view so badly she'd cross the ocean to earn it. Same gate for everybody. That's the one she'd want you to remember. I'm Taildragger. Keep her upright, and I'll see you next time.